So we just want to welcome you all to Bidjigal country. We hope that you enjoy, you know, Michael's efforts and Ellie's efforts and everybody else who's contributed to this movie. Or is it a movie or a documentary?
Movie slash doco.
So welcome to Bidjigal country. We hope that you enjoy it and that, you know, that you go away, like I'm sure I will, filled with hope and inspiration. Thank you.
What we're going to do is just a quick announcement. I think we've got about 20 minutes or something. There's a roving microphone. So whoever wants to ask a question, please, we'll start now. And you can start
here.
All the media people, all the media mob, look, you know, they all take the front, don't they? So, yeah, let's start. People who've got questions.
Yeah, thank you very much for that information. I assume that was on one level and there are other levels to that information. But the question I want to ask you is, in your stories, do you have any traditions about Egyptians, Phoenicians, Chinese coming to Australia?
Well, the mob who has association with Maino in Arnhem Land, for example, and up in the Cape, Bamaga, that mob there have got evidence of their association with the Chinese sailors and long time before before Cook and everybody started venturing into this area. And there are Chinese maps of Australia dating back to the 13th century. They've mapped all of Australia. In fact, it's now in I think Beijing somewhere, and the French have also got some maps as well of that period that where the association. And when I went to The Hague a couple of years ago, about 18 months ago, Ellie and I stayed with a family or groups of people from the Moluccas Islands, from the Molucca. And they're in Amsterdam. And when we spent the time with them, they were telling us about their association with the Aboriginal people in Arnhem Land and you know, and right across that country there, because they actually married into their mob. So there's been a trade and marriage relationship between the Molucca and the Moluccas Islands and the Aboriginal people of Arnhem Land. So we've had a lot of trading going on. So there's been a lot of association. In relation to your question of the Egyptians, there is, in fact, in some of the hieroglyphs of the on the some of the panels in the in those what do you call them, triangle things, pyramids. There are shapes of boomerangs in those.
Actual boomerangs.
Yeah, boomerangs in those. There's drawings there of boomerangs. And if you go to a place in the Kimberleys, and if you go to a place up here at Gosford, you will find hieroglyphics in both places that are Egyptian. So we obviously have had association somewhere along the line. Either that or someone's very good at doing Egyptian stuff. Another one way over. You're going to be fit, bud, by the time you finish this. You don't have to do your 24/7 stuff.
Hi, thanks. My name's Jax, and I just was interested if there is, in the astrophysics side of things, something to comment on the event of the flip of the universe and all the water that is still out there.
It's a really good question. So one thing I'm really interested in is how do these stories relate to current day astrophysics? I guess there's a distance between them in many cases, but what I find interesting that you get stories like, it's not your mob, but mobs who live on the coast have really good understanding of tides, whereas some of our great scientists like Galileo got tides completely wrong. I mean, Galileo is a great man, but everybody has a bad day, right? And and he really understood things like the Earth going around the sun, but he completely misunderstood tides. Whereas you get people who, for thousands of years in Australia, living on the coast, they figured out exactly how the tides work in with the phases of the moon, and they can predict, you know, how when the tide's going to be, how high it is, and so on. So you've got this What I find really interesting is that there's sort of two threads through the Aboriginal knowledge of astronomy. One is all the cultural stuff, and hand in hand with that is a fascination of how the sky works. And there's practical things, you know, the seasons, telling time, how you navigate, how the tides work, when's the right time to look for a particular food, and so on. And they're very closely intertwined in Aboriginal knowledge. It's not, you know, you've got this stuff over here and that stuff over there. And yet there was a tremendous body of knowledge and curiosity about the world, which really reflects, it's very similar to the way we do science. Do you want to comment more on that?
Well, speaking as an anthropologist, really, you know, we hear about cosmology today, and everybody tends to think that we're talking about the universe as Ray studies it. But, you know, cosmology is how any person or any culture understands the universe as they see it. And Aboriginal people had their own cosmology. And Michael's, you know, shown that very clearly in the film as well, that their cosmology was very well ordered and very well planned, and they understood their universe as they saw it. And that's almost scientific in the same sense that modern cosmologists are looking at the universe, just that they were using their eyes and not telescopes.
Sorry, can I just add to that? Because what I find fascinating is talking about the streams and Miami and the streams on the planets. Well, recently they've shown that there's all this kind of web that actually exists, which connects everything in deep space, which isn't like a beautiful, you know, kind of substantiation of the validity of that knowledge. That it's not just stories, but science is actually kind of catching up with the stories to show the physicality to it.
Yeah, we can teach them a lot.
I'm hoping to learn.
There's some people down the front. But just while we've got that, I was fascinated when I was being told this by the old fellow. They said, see them fellows up there? Look, they all tied together up there. The old fellow, he put strings on them to hold them in place so they don't fall away and go out of place. And I, you know, that's just how it was explained to me, and that's the way I knew it. I knew nothing about all that other stuff.
Well, I'm just wondering if you could perhaps tell what you might be able to tell people a little bit about the songlines and the relationship between the stars and the land. I was thinking about one of the stories you were telling with the pelican escorting people home. Pelican person, we've got other pelican people here as well. So our relationship with you, but how that is about sky and land as well. And I think a lot of people probably don't really understand much about those relationships.
Well, as you say, during the creation, there's going to be a second, third sort of film that we're going to do, and it's going to be basically when the old people came and walked upon the earth, and where they created things, and then you get this pattern that goes across Australia. We can only talk about Australia, but how it goes across Australia. And in fact, next year I'm gearing up with the people from the desert. We're going to sing the emu story out of the Western Deserts, right back here to Ku-ring-gai. And we'll bring that story all the way back here from with all the tribes, and we'll pick up all the tribes with those song lines. With that story of the emu, and we'll sing it back, and we'll go through people's country, and they will sing their song, and we'll bring it right back here to sing. Yeah, that'll be 2017. We reckon it's about a 3.5-4 months journey with a lot of people. So those song lines are very important. Yeah.
I'd just like to add to that. I'm working on another project now, basically saltwater people, but connected to it from what Michael has taught me. Is quite a bit of interest in song lines and dreaming tracks. And while a lot of the black people out there would know what I'm talking about, just for the rest of the audience, Australia was literally covered with different travel routes, song lines, dreaming tracks, that were used for both ceremonial, for trade, for resources, and all this ties into the sky as well. Songlines on the earth oftentimes are reflected as songlines in the sky as well. So it's a very interesting area, and I'll be looking forward to seeing what Michael has to do with Ellie on this.
I would like to ask from kind of a more kind of global perspective. My people come from Canada, and my kind of reading.
Can you put that microphone in?
Sorry. Yeah. My people come from Canada, and my kind of reading of the world as a traveling person is that every country that I've ever been to has at its heart that same tradition of singing the land and singing the stories and singing the connection between the sky and the land. And I'm wondering if there is perhaps kind of a global project where we map the whole world by those songs and those stories and the similarities and the kinship that that demonstrates kind of shows that we were global citizens long, long before the internet and long, long before. Well, so I'm just wondering what you're thinking about that might be.
Well, it's already in plan.
Correct.
I was surprised, like, you know, when we do the next one, it'll have a global connection because, you know, the Greeks talk about Thor, the thunder god, and surprisingly enough, I found these mountains in Germany, and they talk about him there.
Yeah.
And but there's also, it's where he was the protector and protecting the serpent, and but he takes the form of a dragon there, and same as the Chinese. And so I've had the great pleasure of meeting people with knowledge about those places, and even in Germany, places like Germany, they have a lot of sacred places that that they don't know about. But I know Aboriginal people can read them. I went there and I saw that, and I've been with old fellows who have gone into France and read there, because the French government took them from Arnhem Land and asked them to read the caves and tell them what the stories are and what those song lines were all about in France. And they started telling them stories that the French just flipped over, you know, they were over the moon about it. And so there's a lot of into this, you know, world knowledge and connection. And we have a story about that serpent. He visits everybody every day. And he sees everybody every day. And, that's his job, is to make sure everything's right, in order.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
So I find your question really interesting. It's something I'm going to be really boring. I'm a really nuts and bolts type of guy, right? We look around the world and we find that in almost every culture there's a story about the Seven Sisters, a group of young girls or women, and there's Orion next door, young men, hunters, something like that. Generally chasing the girls in the Pleiades. Okay, that's interesting. But hold on, why those particular constellations? You look at the stories of the Southern Cross, they're different everywhere. You look at the stories of most constellations, they're different everywhere. But the Orion and the Seven Sisters, you get this story, versions of the story popping up everywhere. And then you think, hang on, why does everybody talk about the Seven Sisters? There aren't seven. I mean, have you looked at them? You know, depending on your eyesight, if you've got eyesight like mine, it's a fuzzy blob, right? But maybe you see four stars or six stars, right? Nobody sees them as seven. No point in the last 100,000 years has anybody seen seven stars, and yet everybody calls them seven. And then you get stories in various parts of the world where one of the sisters gets taken away. Is that an attempt to reconcile the story, which we all believe in, with what we actually see, which doesn't quite fit the story? There's an enormous amount of information about that. My guess, it's a guess, right? I'm a scientist. All we do is guess. So the best of our knowledge, we all came out of Africa some like 100,000 years ago, whether you were Aboriginal or Chinese or European.
No, not us.
No? No, okay.
No,
this is my belief.
Yeah, this is science.
Yeah, that's right. And so perhaps this is a really, really old story that comes from way back. We also found a campfire in Africa telling, and we all brought these to our various countries. I don't know. Anyway, it's work in progress again. But suddenly there's lots of information there if we can only figure it out.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's all very interesting. I like the story about how you skip a generation to compress the stories. But some of these stories, as we just heard, might go back tens, hundreds of thousands of years. How do you compress these stories by using patterns in the stars?
We follow the stories. And when we talk about the compression of knowledge, you know, my mum's still alive. She's in the back there. And my mum's great-grandmother, she was born before the white man came here. And she died when my mother was about 8 or 9 years old. And my mother learned a lot of stuff off her and watched her dance and watched her sing. Now, my mother now has great-great-grandchildren herself. So what we've got in one woman is 8 generations of people. Yeah, and so if she's learned knowledge from that old woman, well, then from 1830s now to 2016, we can say we have one woman in that 8-generation period who has all that knowledge, who can carry all that knowledge. So there's a lot of people in this country, old people, who have the same knowledge and they even skip those generations. So it's from 1 to 8 generations, there's one person in the middle who holds all the stories. And so when you talk about compressing knowledge, then that's how we keep that knowledge in such a raw form and in such a real form that we don't lose. You know, like I tell Bob something, he'll go away and build on that story somewhere else. And, you know, they've done these experiments. But when you say this is sacred knowledge and you can't change that law, we don't change the law, because we get sick if we change that law. We start telling lies and start mucking up. We learned our lesson. Yeah, and that's what this is about. We've learned our lesson, and so we've got to carry on that law. So the skipping of the generations is very important. It's not about skipping the generations. It's retaining the knowledge in its rawest form and in the most pristine state as we can maintain it. And so we don't have the ability to add on to it. We can only tell it as it is, as it's been passed down.
Good example. Recently there was some research that was published here in Australia where a study group went around Australia looking for stories about sea level rise on the coast communities. And I think it was about 25 different communities that they went to and looked for stories. And in most of those communities, they had found stories about the sea rising and the fact that people had to move and were displaced. And then they were able to find information about the topography of the area where the people left. And then they went and looked at the seabed off the coast in these areas. And with a very high level of accuracy, they were able to find these islands and places where people had left, which indicates, given that the last sea level rise was about 8 to 10,000 years ago, that they were able to pass on oral knowledge over that long period of time. Before that, if you'd asked anybody, the scientists at least, would say, oh, maybe 600-700 years you could pass knowledge on. So this is a big breakthrough.
Good evening. Michael, Ray and Robert, thank you for an excellent presentation tonight and giving us this opportunity to discuss these.
I think you missed our Ellie, who's actually the real star.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
In fact, let's make up by giving Ellie another round of applause.
I apologise, Ellie. I haven't been introduced to you. My name's Mary and I'm from down south. And if I can just ask 2 questions. First of all, Michael, I'm really interested in the fact of the songlines, because down in the Sutherland Shire, there is an engraving of 2 women and their child, and there is a duckbill, and they have webbed feet. So I'm interested on your thoughts as to whether this would be part of the songline that would be part of the whole of, well, there's no such thing as New South Wales in an Aboriginal perspective, that would this be part of a song line across Australia? And secondly, as far as my understanding, every Indigenous culture had a creation serpent, and we've got a huge one about 30 feet down at Waterfall. Is there any stories that you can tell us in terms of what you've been seeing from the sky that explains the coming and the actions of this creation serpent?
If I can just address the two women and the one with the webbed feet, that's also in another location in Australia, that same picture. And I won't talk about that because that belongs to someone else, but I do know it's there. So what you're telling me is that's a second location where that engraving is. In relation to the serpent, the serpent, he connects to most of us. He has a connection. We all have the story about the rainbow serpent. We're back home. We don't talk about the serpent. We talk about Kuria, which is the crocodile, and he travels through our country. You go to other places, they talk about the crocodile as well. And then other places, they talk about the serpent, the snake. You go to Japan, you go to foreign countries, and you begin to talk about this sort of stuff, about the creation stories. They all have a serpent in it, no matter where it is. And if you're in China, they talk about the dragon. The Indians in India, they talk about a similar dragon. So you've got these similar features all around the world. And I've had the fortune of being able to travel to most continents on this earth and be able to see those things and hear those stories and see some of those places. So it's a matter of putting a lot of it together and making sure that we get it together. But, you know, I'm only allowed to live for so long. And unfortunately, I'm hoping he gives me an extension of another 50 years up there. But there's a lot of things I've got to do yet. But you're right. There are stories, and we have stories that come from a place called Tinga, up near Tamworth there, and another little town called, what's that place called? I'll think of it as we talk. And that's where them two crocodiles separated there when they were fallen during the creation, and they came down through the Sydney here, and he turned around down here in the what we now know as the Sydney aquifers or the Sydney basin, and he went back up, the crocodile went back that way, and that serpent. So he finished down here, I know, at the Shoalhaven River, and we have storylines that come from the Bunya Mountains and up there, the Bogong moth story. And we are part, we know that Bogong moth story, and because we got Bogong moths in our country. And because of that, we go into the bunk, we come across to the mountains when they bring the ceremony down, because they follow the Bogong moth story all the way down to Victoria. And all the tribes from the coast and from the west all meet along those ranges at ceremony grounds during the Bogong moth period, right from up here north of Toowoomba at a place called Crow's Nest, all the way down to, what's that place down there, where the last bit of snow anyway, down that way near the Dandenong somewhere. And then they meet up with that mob down in Victoria. So that, and that snake story, that serpent story, is met and he's brought together to meet with the Bogong moth all the way along those ranges, what we call the Great Divide.
I just wanted to echo everybody's thanks for the presentation. It was very, very, very interesting and particularly heartening to see a dialogue between this kind of this incredibly ancient culture and this relatively new exploit. And I just wondered if we would perhaps see almost a circle reconnecting between kind of the scientific era, as the Western world knows it, and then the Indigenous culture and Indigenous science, and perhaps we're kind of maybe seeing other areas of science following suit and continuing to connect these two histories.
Yeah, well, this fella, he pestered me for a long time, you know, and he still does from time to time. But, you know, Bob sort of came up with this idea which kicked my ass and made me do something, you know. He wanted to do something about this. And Bob, this American, you know, it's terrible. He's an American. Not an Australian, you know.
No, I am an Aussie now.
Oh, you are an Aussie now. Okay, yeah.
Unlike you, Bob and I have got pieces of paper which says we're Australian. Right, okay. You don't have that.
Yeah, I know. That's I know. That's terrible. That's like them fellows who go in the madhouse. At least they get one to say that they're sane.
That's right.
And they come out. You know. But the thing is that you know, Bob wanted got into this. I don't know what inspired him, but. And he contacted me, and, you know, I have a lot of people, mad people, ring me up and ask me about things. But this fellow rang me up and said, you know, I want to learn about something. I'm doing a master's, and I want to do this here, and I want to do that there. And I said, yeah, all right. Well, okay, we'll see if you're fair dinkum. And anyway, he came out home, and he saw a little bit of heaven.
Yeah. It is God's country up there, as they say.
Dry, but God's country, yeah. And, of course, Ellie, and we've been dealing with another thing because her husband, Kevin Gilbert, the very famous Aboriginal poet, has been, we've always been on the political sort of angle, and then all of a sudden Bob comes up and then he says, oh, we might be able to do something about, you know, filming us. Well, you throw Ellie in the mix. And, you know, so, you know, she's becoming a movie maker, so we might get a loser to filmmaking and politics. So, but yeah, it's a different sphere. But we're starting to see how, strangely enough, you know, as a result of Bob's sort of wanting to learn, and like quite frankly, I don't like anthropologists because they're the greatest stealers of knowledge of all professions. Yeah, and they go away and write books and they say that's theirs, and the courts recognise them as the authority, and I'm the fellow who give the story, but I'm not an authority. I'm not an expert. The fellow with the piece of paper is the expert, you know. And that's a bit of a shame. So I was a little bit hesitant, but Bob's being very persistent, and I give thanks to him in some ways for his persistence.
Well, I think Michael was probably one of the first people in the country who probably has recognized that while the old people, the elders, and the knowledge holders will have this knowledge. The important thing now is that, at least on the non-sacred level, is that this knowledge is available to the general public, and particularly to kids for education. And actually, the purpose of this, of the original film, which Ellie has now taken well beyond anything that I could have even imagined, the purpose of that original film was for a school education program, which is now being trialed at some of the schools up in the north around Michael's country. And I think that's really the important thing with this knowledge, is that not only does it get out there so that us white people can understand Indigenous science and knowledge, but also that kids, not just Indigenous kids, but all kids, can learn about the wonderful knowledge that's still here and still available in this country.
Apparently, we just have time for one more question.
Thanks again, April here. I was just marvelling at the way the story developed and all the different imagery and components of the sky that we were looking at and understanding. And I wondered if Ellie could shed a little bit of light on the process of creating the film and how that links to the stories, and if there's some linearity. I know there's no linearity in Aboriginal culture, but just if there's a first story and then a last story, and how that develops throughout ceremony and a person's development, and how that links to the way you've portrayed that in the film. I think it's really beautiful to hear about that storytelling and how that has come through.
Thank you. Basically, it's done on the run. So just as an example, the first part of the Seven Sisters story, we'd already filmed up at Mogalang. And then I'm learning as I'm going, so then I find out, well, those seven sisters are the seven lakes that I already knew. So we're over in Kempsey with the Dungati not long ago. I'm going to Michael, can't we just say what the name of those lakes are? And so we'd spent 2 days with the elders up there, somewhere here tonight. Thank you. And we had like half an hour left before we had to go somewhere else, so he's down there. And they don't just tell us the name of the lakes, but then the whole story of the platypus, right, just came out at the last minute. So then I thought, well, we can't leave that out. And so it's basically then what's in your mind. I know what I filmed over all these years, so I know, oh, I've got a picture of that, you know. Same with the moon and the sun. Years and years ago, I filmed that little gecko, and so I've got to find it and put it in. And so it's just a continual building process of putting overlay onto the story and understanding the story enough to know how to do it without having actors and other people in it. And, yeah, the story unravels. I'm still trying to finish this one, and this is like the second part of what followed on from Bob's. And Michael's, he's already on 3 and 4 down the track. You know, hang on. We've got to finish this one first. But, yeah, it's a work in progress. And I've actually talked to, because we actually live on a river which has got platypus, but they're terribly hard to film, as my grandkids know. We're down there morning and night sometimes trying to get them. But again, there's this really goodwill. So at Healesville in Victoria, where they breed the platypus, they're happy if I go down there and film. I don't have to pay $200 to have a special view of them. I can go and film them, and so we'll build that into the story. So, yeah, work in progress.
But one thing, we've got to go because I can see the guy I'll be ready to answer all out. One thing that I've learned, though, from Ellie editing and cutting all this stuff, you know, and it's you know, pretty new knowledge. I didn't know she was that talented. When it comes to making it, made it, you know, they, like this woman here, I thought she was all politics, you know, until I seen this ear thing here. Now, this is the first time I thought it. But one thing that we have learned along the way, and Ellie tells me about it, and that is the goodwill that's out there, and the people who, when Ellie's made inquiries, she's told me about people saying, oh, well, this will cost $250, normally not, or, you know, it's all right, it just, you know, I'll give you the stuff, and because this is interesting, this is important. And so when you've got that goodwill around, I think we can make Australia much richer.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good one. Thank you.
Congratulations.